This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
It's my pleasure to welcome Sandra Navidi to the show. She is the founder and CEO of Beyond Global and author of a book on a fascinating topic that I'm sure is going to be very interesting. It's a mysterious topic. The book is entitled Super Hubs, How the Financial Elite and Their Networks Rule Our World. Sandra, welcome. How are you?
Thank you so much, Jason. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And you're coming to us from New York City, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. We all have certainly heard about things like the famous meetings in Davos, Switzerland, the Bilderberg Group, all of these financial and power hubs around the world. There are so many more than just those two that I mentioned, of course. But tell us a little bit about this world, this rather mysterious world of super hubs and the financial elite and how they rule our world.
Well, I started out writing about networks about 5 years ago, and I was always kind of drawn back to the financial world because finance is the operating system of our society and everything that we do is based on finance. It has a very basic fundamental role in all our lives, and therefore the people who have the most power in this area also have the most influence on our lives. For instance, central banks decide, you know, how money is created, or the CEOs of financial institutions, they decide how capital flows are employed and have therefore influence on industries and jobs and currencies and how much we pay for our mortgages and so forth. So that's why I focused on the financial industry. But we see these networks in all areas. We see them in the corporate world. We see them in the political world. And all of these networks sort of overlap multidimensionally. And the people who are at the intersections and at the centers, the super hubs, have the most power.
Maybe a lot of our listeners have heard this thing about that 12 families basically run the world. Is that true?
Well, I think at some point in time that probably was true, but we still hear sort of conspiracy theories about the Rothschilds and the Soros and so forth. And I think that is sort of overblown. But what is true is that there are networks of people who are extremely influential. And actually, a university, the Technical Institute in Switzerland, did a study and actually analyzed hundreds of thousands of companies all around the world. And what they found out through quantitative methods and computer models is that the ownership of most of our transnational corporation goes back to just a handful of companies. And those companies, especially the top 10, are almost all financial institutions of big names that you've heard and the listeners have heard. And of course, the CEOs of these institutions, that gives them enormous power. Yes, they are interchangeable. But for instance, if you look at someone like Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, he has been in his position for years. And so have many other people, especially those who, for instance, have created investment management companies like, say, Steve Schwarzman of Blackstone or Larry Fink of BlackRock, which is the largest asset management company in the world and manages over $5 trillion. And so these people form networks and they meet all around the world all year long. They have a sort of migration route that starts in January with the World Economic Forum, and then they meet at the IMF meetings and the Aspen Festival, and, you know, they go every year. And they also have a transnational identity, the so-called Davos families. Even if they have a different native tongue, for instance, say with Joe Ackerman, who used to be the CEO of Deutsche Bank, or say an Indian central bank governor, they're very familiar with each other and they speak the same shorthand, the same lingo, and they have more in common with each other than they have oftentimes than with their countrymen. And I think that's also sort of the problem that we're seeing now, that they form the 1% and they alienate the rest of the populations. And that's why we see a forming revolt and polarization and a populism all over the world.
That's very interesting, the remark you just made about how they have more in common with each other than their country or their countrymen. So this is not a nationalistic thing. It's a, well, a capitalistic thing. Here's the funny thing. I like caught myself when I said capitalistic thing, because my contention is that the world of elite finance, the world of Wall Street or any stock markets around the world, they're really not very capitalistic at all. They're cronyist. They're all in bed with the government. They're all secretly loving government regulations because it keeps competitors out, although they may complain about it in public forums. You know, that's just maybe an aside to it. But very interesting. So what are they doing to us or for us when they exert power over all the rest of us in the hoi polloi? What are they doing to us? How does it impact our lives?
May I go one step back, because you said it's a capitalist system, and I would even say it's just a human system, because the dynamics that form these elite networks are the same that you see in a small city, at a university, everywhere where humans come together. Mm-hmm. It's very basic network dynamics, because basically one of the premises of my book is that finance is a complex self-organizing system. Just like, for instance, an ant colony or a brain or the ecology. And there are certain dynamics that will always create the same structures. For instance, in finance, economies of scale are rewarded. So people there will try always to form as many connections as they can with people they have the most in common with. And that makes their interests, you know, more similar. So they're all pushing for the same thing. So I think on the most basic level, it's not a nefarious scheme. I would say it's not an immoral system, it's an amoral system. So people do what everybody does. They do what's in their best interest. And oftentimes their individual action isn't necessarily negative for other people. But in the aggregate, if all these people act in the same way, that makes the whole system more homogeneous and more skewed. And that's when negative effects for the rest of the population is a result.
Right. And I would agree with you. I'm not necessarily saying that it's immoral. Certainly believe in money and capitalism and all of that kind of stuff. I think that's really quite freeing for everybody. And it's very natural. But certainly they do throw their weight around. There's no question about that. Talk to us a little bit about how they throw their weight around. And, you know, to my other question, I know you wanted to explain that, but let's go back to the kind of the main thrust there. What do they do to or for all the rest of us in the world? What do they control? How does it impact our lives?
Well, first of all, bank bosses, for instance, or investment fund managers, they have certain interests that are good for them. That could be regulation, that could be taxation, and they're very tightly intertwined with Washington, if we just take the U.S. I mean, all over the world, but I think that because of party financing, this whole system is a little bit more extreme here than it is, for instance, in my home country, which is Germany. There's more of a separation. So the fact that here parties and political candidates can be financed by the financial industry, which has the most money, obviously, therefore they can buy the most influence. And I have one chapter in my book which I call "It's Legalized Corruption, the Best Democracy That Money Can Buy." And I think there is something to it. And when I say that generally it's not a nefarious scheme and it's amoral, of course, there's always a fine line. What is inappropriate, what is unethical, and what is illegal. And sometimes it's hard to draw this line. And of course, there are also always people who take advantage of the system.
Right.
So when I say the system is generally amoral, I'm not talking about these systems, the bad apples, you know, that are always there in every profession.
Sure, sure. Well, I agree with you. Okay, so to that question about how it affects our lives.
Okay, so for instance, today the Federal Reserve decided that the interest rates are going to be increased again. So there's Janet Yellen. Before her, it was Bernanke. And of course, there is a whole team around her. She doesn't make the decision all on her own, of course, but she has the greatest influence. And for instance, Bernanke, he actually had 2 terms, and he was there throughout the financial crisis. So he had extreme influence, and he was very tightly interconnected with all the bank bosses that came in. And, you know, there are official logs how many times they talked with each other, and also the finance ministry. And if you look at the people, and I give one example in the book, because the interconnections are so many that it gets confusing. But if you look at Geithner and Blankfein and like all these people from Goldman Sachs and the ones, the Washington politicians, how everything is interconnected, it's really mind-blowing. But of course, like everyone else, you know, even like, say, a small business owner in a small city, everybody likes to do business with other people who they know and trust. And those people we know and trust usually happen to be people who we have something in common with. And so these people feel comfortable with each other. And when they take up a new position, like, for instance, when Obama came into office, he hired Rubin for his transition team. And Obama had promised change. And Rubin was a trusted person. When he had worked under Clinton, and Clinton had actually created a position for him, it was later said he often made decisions and acted against his own interest. He had the interest of the people in mind, so he got very good reviews. So when he started working for Obama, he brought all his Rubinites back and all the people that he had known who were his friends or, you know, the people he had worked with before, and he got criticized for that. And Sheila Bair, who used to be the head of the FDIC, she wrote in her book, she couldn't believe it. It was like a punch in her stomach that, you know, she saw all these people back in who she held responsible, at least in part, for the crisis that had happened. But you see that how these systems work and how these networks, they keep themselves alive unless there is disruption like we are currently seeing with Trump.
Okay, so I want to talk about Trump. First of all, is he a member of this clan? I mean, Trump is, he's got a few bucks.
No, it's not just money. I've seen him over the years here in New York and met him in passing. And you could tell, even as an outsider, when I was new to New York, I could tell he wasn't one of them, of the super hubs. He was very well liked. He was wealthy enough to be at the same parties and events and live in the same neighborhoods and all of that sort. He had the accoutrements of wealth. But people, I don't think, identified themselves with him. He was a colorful character, mostly also because of his TV show and his media activities. He was on these radio shows, and he was always somewhere in public and did something slightly crazy, like stirring the radio show to gain attention. And so people liked him. He was always polite and friendly and charming. No clue that he could be so rude and offensive like he was in parts of his campaign. But he didn't belong to the system. And I think that's what he ran his campaign on. That was the perception of the people who voted for him. And it is partially true. The only thing is, now that he's coming into power, most likely, he is bringing in networks. He didn't really have networks that were of use to him, maybe a little bit here and there, but not mainly powerful, established networks. So he hooked up with this tech titan, Peter Thiel, who's bringing his tech network in. Steve Schwarzman, who he has known from the social circle, and Schwarzman and his wife were at Trump's wedding, for instance, in Palm Beach. So they've known each other for a long time socially. I don't think they've done business before. But Steve came in, and he's going to bring in, he's the chair of the Strategic and Business Advisory Panel, or something like that. So he's bringing in all these other business leaders, like Jamie Dimon and so forth. So you see through the back door, all these old established networks are coming back in. They're not going to let go. Among them, of course, most prominently, Goldman Sachs. There are currently four people, most likely, who will be in a closed advisory circle or get official positions. So they have, as always, great influence.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Can anybody get into this this elite group? Or like you said, that Trump isn't involved. I assume he would want to be, but he has he's not part of this, even though he's got the money. He doesn't have the connections. By the way, you mentioned to me before, you're critical of Trump. You're not a Trump supporter, it sounds like, right? Just to know
right.
Where you're coming from.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is access possible for people? You know, is it purely old money or can new money get in, or how does that all work?
It is possible to get in, but it's getting harder and harder. One example is Anthony Scaramucci, who I also mention in my book, and I explain his rise within networks and how he became a super up, and now he's a close advisor to Trump. He came from very humble beginnings, but he went to Harvard. He did all the things you have to do to get into the circle. I think in the 80s, he could still work as a trader at Bear Stearns and sport bad manners and go to a strip club, and he could still rise amongst the ranks. Mm-hmm. And that has changed. The zeitgeist has changed. The culture has changed, especially in investment banking. It's more of a genteel culture. And what all these people have in common, they're all obviously very smart. Everybody knows that. But now there are scientific studies to corroborate that.
Mm-hmm.
And also they all have gone to elite schools. They all have these networks. They're all male. I think in the U.S. there is one female CEO, and that is the daughter of the Fidelity founder who retired. Mm-hmm. I have her name at the top of my tongue right now. And then in Europe, there's one of Santander because her father passed away, and that's it. So the entry-level diversity has become greater, but the higher you go, the fewer women you will find. So it's predominantly male. So it's very hard to get into these circles, and very few people make it.
This is fascinating stuff. I want to ask you, and I want to make sure we get to this, what can people do? What should listeners, knowing about what you're saying, is there any action they can take to maybe invest better or increase their own wealth and influence? You know, is there any action item here, or is this just something that's, interesting?
It depends where you're coming from. If you want to make more money, if you want to capitalize on the existing system, I guess you have to get into networks and you have to get as close as you can to super hubs because they preside over access and information and opportunities. And everybody who's a super hub eventually gets rich, like Ben Bernanke, as an example, the former head of the Fed, throughout his life has made, at least in the last few years at the Fed, $200,000 per year.
$180,000. Yep. Amazing.
Yeah. Right. And when he left, a friend told me, I have to rely on this word, it was one of the first speaking engagements he did after he left the Fed. He paid him $750,000. So before, he got $200,000 for a whole year's work. When he left, it was $750,000 for an hour. So that's just an extreme example. But the point is, what super hubs have and what makes them special is their access to other high-powered people and therefore to information and business opportunities. However, one point in my book, the further we get to the end, is I say these super hubs and human systems, especially our financial system, has become increasingly more fragile because it's become more homogeneous and super hubs have disabled corrective mechanisms. Like you see in the ecology, usually when humans don't interfere, if something becomes too skewed, say a species becomes too prolific, then you'll see somehow dynamics that will correct this and even out, balance out the situation again. In our financial system, we are not seeing this. And the financial crisis would have been a good catalyst to actually do some fundamental corrections in our system. But that hasn't happened. We just have kicked the can down the road. So this is why people are rightly very concerned about a much bigger crisis in the global financial system. Because since the crisis, indebtedness has risen to a level that we have never seen before. And the McKinsey study has recently stated that also.
Is there a list of all of the what you call super hubs somewhere? Is it in your book? How many super hubs are there? I guess it's just a matter of degree, right?
It's a matter of degree and where you draw the line. I have described a number of them in my book, but those with greater name recognition, because I also wanted this book to be an interesting read for people who are not experts. But I guess you could say just generally people who had financial institutions, either, in the private economy like banks or official institutions like the IMF or central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, these positions are all incredibly powerful. And then it's the interplay between those people because every person, every super hub individually is very powerful, but the extreme power and the influence on the system comes through the connections. So in a way, the connections between super hubs are more important than the super hubs themselves.
Yeah. Do you remember, or know offhand how many super hubs you identify in your book? I'm just really curious to kind of get a number on this. And I know it depends where you draw the line, obviously.
I would say, I haven't counted them at the top of my head. I would say I probably profile more 10 or 12 more closely and in detail. And then I mention a number of others, but I did not want to get too confusing because I remember when I was new to the system, quote unquote, I got confused and I didn't know what I didn't really know what the IMF did and mm-hmm. the Bank for International Settlements.
Most people still don't.
Right. And throw in all these names of institutions. And then on top of that, the names, I guess, really confusing. And also my book got rejected twice before mm-hmm. for being too academic and too theoretic. And I was encouraged to tell my story through stories, basically, to mm-hmm. make it more tangible. Mm-hmm. And so it should be somewhat entertaining.
You mentioned the Federal Reserve chairs, Bernanke and Yellen, a couple of times. And I wanted to just ask you about that, because one thing that I recently learned this has absolutely stunned me. I cannot believe it. So Janet Yellen, when she came in and became Fed chair, many people talked about how she was the wealthiest Fed chair, at least incoming Fed chair. I'm sure many of them know how to make their investments prosper dramatically as Fed chair, most powerful financial person on the planet. And her net worth was $13 million coming in. You know, and this is, of course, according to Celebrity Net Worth, which, you know, I have no idea how credible this website is, but a lot of people use it. It's sort of interesting for kicks, if nothing else. According to this website, Janet Yellen, as of 2016, is worth $13 million. Ben Bernanke, this just floored me, only $3 million. And Alan Greenspan, our former Fed chair, the most famous Fed chair, I would argue, Alan Greenspan, certainly probably the longest serving, or at least in modern history, a $10 million net worth. Now, look it, I cannot possibly be worth more than Ben Bernanke and possibly Alan Greenspan. You know, that just can't be. Those people must be much more wealthy than that. Am I wrong?
So what's your point, that you doubt those numbers?
I
you think
doubt
that they
those
are...
numbers. I mean, this is the most powerful financial position on earth. I mean, wouldn't you agree that it is? You know, Ben Bernanke can't be worth just $3 million. Really? That's
I wouldn't be surprised, because also the distinction that I make in the book between those people and, say, fund managers is that they're driven by different motivations. I think people like Bernanke and Yellen are scientists, academics, they're passionate about economics. They're not driven by greed, and I don't mean greed in a bad way, but not necessarily by money. They're into science and occupied with that. Actually, I think I heard Janet Yellen's net worth was something around maybe $6 million. I'm not sure. Maybe they combined it with her husband's wealth, but she's almost 70 years old, and there were some very good years before. So I thought actually your point was that she made a lot of money.
No, I think they're relatively poor. I mean, compared to anybody on Wall Street, you know, there are lots of just people none of us have ever heard of that are just, you know, traders that are much richer than any of these three Federal Reserve chairs. It's mind-blowing to me how not rich they are. I can't believe it's true.
I totally believe it. And also during their terms, I'm sure they have very strict conflict of interest provisions where they can trade and they can engage in certain activities, I'm sure. And they're monitored very strictly.
Listen, I agree with you, but I'm just saying, look, we all know, Sandra, all of these politicians, I mean, every member of Congress, they somehow or other seem to, and these aren't politicians, I get that. You know, they're not exactly politicians, I know that. But, you know, they somehow come into Congress with no money, and then somehow they become very rich, you know, serving in some part of the government, not just Congress. Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen and Alan Greenspan are not saints. They need money too. Money impacts them. They're, you know, I get that they're academic and wonky, and but there's a lot of wonky academic people on Wall Street. The quants, you know, that's a huge category of Wall Street people. They're absolutely zillionaires. You know, not an exact figure, of course. But that just floors me. I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
I do believe it. And I think politicians and the ones that we hear about in Congress, they're all between 60 and 70 years old. So they've been there for a long time. And I think even though they're politicians, they have oftentimes the minds of business people. They interact with lobbyists and they're freer. They have a different mindset and there's more that they can do. Whereas, you know, most Fed people have worked at, you know, they have had academic careers beforehand. So I think it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, that's quite fascinating to me. What else would you like people to know about super hubs and this whole very interesting topic?
Well, one point that I didn't finish earlier was you asked me what people should take away from the book. And I started saying, okay, people who want to make a lot of money, they should, you know, get close to super hubs. But another point in my book, and actually it's kind of funny when I talk about the book, which towards the end, it gets quite a serious, ends on a serious note, but people always come to me and they want to know how to become a super hub and how they can improve their networking. Even people on Wall Street who obviously have been very good at it, they say, oh, I always forget, you know, I know that I should do it, but I'm so glad you reminded me of it and so forth. But what I say is for all of us and the sake for our financial system, we need to be concerned about this, about these super hubs. And I actually think that we're seeing a more extreme formation under Trump right now. That's going to be more extreme than anything else we've seen before. because, even leaving out Trump, because our system is becoming more skewed and more homogeneous, and it's going to fail at some point. That's what the IMF says, the OECD, the Bank for International Settlements, the Bank of England, all the experts agree. Nobody can say, though, exactly when this is going to happen. But one of the points that I'm making, and of course, I don't have a panacea of how to correct the situation, but what would certainly help would be to increase diversity. If we had more women and more ethnic diversity, it would balance out viewpoints and it would represent the interests of the population better. And diversity also in nature and everywhere stabilizes systems, and homogeneity always weakens systems, and it kind of makes sense. So this is one of the points towards the end of my book. So I think what we should take away of it, I say that we need to understand that it's a complex system. There is no conspiracy at the base of it, okay? So in order to be able to do something that makes sense, we need to employ a systemic view, a systems view of the system, and employ complexity thinking. So what we've done before until now is we've viewed things primarily in silos, economics, political science, philosophy, sociology, and so forth, and have been different. Separate disciplines, and we need to view systems in their entirety to be able to find solutions that will actually cure the system. An example that I'm giving is that after the financial crisis and the aftermath, we wanted to improve banking regulation. And so Dodd-Frank came into being, and the effect was that we only focused on banks, that a lot of risk has migrated into shadow banks. And now we have much greater risk in a sector that where there's basically very little overview, and we've created other new risks. And so this is one, I can't give solutions, obviously.
The law of unintended consequences. It always happens with regulation like Dodd-Frank is a disaster. I mean, Dodd-Frank needs to be repealed or at least massively revised. It's terrible. I mean, being in the real estate industry, I see it firsthand all the time, but yeah. Very interesting. And your point is that the power is in too few hands. You want to see a more diversified power base. And I would agree with you completely, Sandra. That is always a recipe for a disaster. In fact, that's exactly why central planning and communism and socialism don't work very well, because the power is too concentrated and not dispersed widely enough, right?
Exactly. And what I say is that if we don't correct our system ourselves, it will correct itself, and it will come through the incipient revolt that we're seeing everywhere. And I think if Trump is going to disappoint his voters by not living up to his promises and doing exactly the opposite of what he said he would do, you know, we may see a revolt and social instability. And I think that could be very dangerous.
Well, it certainly could. I mean, listen, I don't know when the last time any politician kept their promises was, so I'm not going to be particularly critical of Trump yet, because he's not president yet, but we shall see. I mean, I've certainly been critical of him on prior shows, but we'll see where he goes. We'll just have to wait and see how he governs. But politicians not keeping their promises, I mean, what's new, right? That's a cliche.
But putting his family in power, and then generals and Goldman Sachs people and all old white men, just seems to indicate an extreme power concentration. And then his efforts to criticize the press and stifle criticism, it's all going in a direction that we've seen in Turkey with Erdogan.
But it's interesting. Hang on just a second. You know, how he criticizes the media. I mean, it's kind of interesting because he is making a huge enemy out of the media. You know, wouldn't he want the media to be kind to him, to go easy on him? You know, he's just, right out in front of them. It's really bold. It's, or stupid. I don't know. We'll see how that plays out. But the media is going to hate Trump. I mean, they already do, right?
Right. But I do think journalists get intimidated. I've talked with journalists, and some of them are not citizens, and they're afraid about their green card. And, you know, they're starting to be worried, and they may be more careful in the future of what they say about Trump. And then there's always his option of extinguishing critical voices and then putting his own state press, like Putin has, in power.
Well, we're jumping way ahead, aren't we, on that? I mean, listen, I don't want to have a political argument, but, you know, look at, yeah, it's a concern, but, you know, he's not even in power yet. So yeah, we've got to see what happens there. But yeah, it's interesting and it is a concern. I agree with you. So Sandra, give out your website and tell people where they can find out more. And the book is only on pre-order, right? When is it coming out?
The book is coming out in January and it can be ordered on Amazon. And my website is beyondglobal.com, beyond-global.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Sandra Navidi.
Fantastic. Sandra Navidi, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this very interesting behind-the-scenes world with all of us. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to have been with you, Jason. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, artmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.